Now we got to go to a totally different ball game, and that is to Plotinus. Between Plato and Aristotle and Plotinus, between 300 BC and 200 AD, there's nothing of any real significance that went on. As a matter of fact, between Augustine, 400 AD, and Anselm, 1000 AD, there's nothing of any significance that went on. So you can pick the great people in the history of thought. You can hopscotch through the history of thought and get it all and get it better, because you get bogged down in these little pygmies. Instead of studying the giants, you miss it anyway. So we'll skip a few pygmies here and go to 200 AD and look at Plotinus for another reason. Plotinus is the fountainhead of a wholly different way of experiencing God that we'll get from Plotinus right on through the mystics, Meister Eckhart, right on up through the modern liberals, Schleiermacher, into even existentialists like Kierkegaard. And that is, up to this point, we've assumed that God can be known, religious epistemology, knowing God, that God can be known through the reason. Maybe God is known through mystical intuitions, or maybe God is known by pure faith, or maybe God is known by an existential leap. That has to also be part of our total religious epistemology. You can't fairly study the history of religious epistemology without studying the mystical tradition. And the mystical tradition, for better or for worse, kind of like marriage, for better or for worse, I couldn't do better, she couldn't do worse, comes from Plotinus. Plotinus is the fountainhead of medieval and modern mysticism. If you don't understand Plotinus, you can't understand Meister Eckhart, you can't understand most of the spiritualistic traditions following him. The life and works of Plotinus. Born in Lycopolis, Upper Egypt, 250 AD, studied 11 years with a Neoplatonist, Ammonius Saccas, who never wrote any books, apparently. He was a classmate of the church father Origen. That's a very important connection. Origen, the father of Neoplatonism and allegorical method in Christianity, got it from the same source as Plotinus did, under Ammonius Saccas, a Neoplatonic philosopher.
That's a quick question about Origen. Remember, you referred to him
Well, he was a professing Christian. He was an apologist, and he wrote books defending Christianity as opposed to some of the great heresies like Gnosticism and others of his day.
The books that you would consider Orthodox?
Origen is a mixed bag. He has Orthodox doctrines, and he has unorthodox doctrines. Is he unorthodox? He's unorthodox on views X, Y, and Z, and he's orthodox on views A, B, and C. He was a classmate of Origen, and Plotinus was. Porphyry became his student in 263, and Plotinus died possibly of leprosy around 270 AD. Porphyry was the one who really put the one book Plotinus wrote together. It's called the Enneads. And the Enneads, from about 253 to 268, they were edited by Porphyry. He arranged them into six sections called Enneads. Enneads means nine. Nine was apparently a sacred number to the Neoplatonists, as seven was to the Jews. The view of Plotinus about reality first. Now notice, his epistemology flows directly out of his metaphysics. We're going to be studying A, B, and C, and D here. In fact, A through E are all his metaphysics. And if you understand how he views reality, then under Roman numeral 3, his view of faith and knowledge will make sense. His view of reality is the one beyond being. There is a one, an absolute beyond being reality. This is the ultimate source of all things. Everything else flows out of this. Think of it as the center of a circle. And think of everything else in the world as radii coming out of the center of the circle. So you got an absolute center, and everything flowing out of it. You got the one at the top. It's beyond all reason. You can't think it. You can't really know it in any way. It's absolutely simple. It doesn't have any will. This one is not a person. It doesn't feel anything. It doesn't will anything, and it doesn't think anything. It's just an absolute, ultimate, metaphysical reality from which everything flows. It's like the sun is to the rays. or like a seed is to the flower. The flower unfolds from it, the rays ray from it, but it's beyond all that. The next level down, now what's very important about that is once you say that, you've already determined your epistemology. Why? If that's true, if what we normally call God, and Plotinus calls the One, is beyond thinking, beyond knowing, beyond all reason, then your epistemology is decided. Your religious epistemology was already decided right there, wasn't it? What is your religious epistemology going to be? Can't know it. Can't think it. Can't describe it. There are no universals. There are no essences. There's nothing that really corresponds to it. Religious language can't be analogous to it. It's got to be equivocal. Everything was just already decided once you made that decision. So if his metaphysics is right, his epistemology is right. Now what if you reverse this? His epistemology is going to end up being a mystical epistemology. What is the one thing you can do with it? Feel it. Intuit it in some mystical way. Now suppose you start with a feeling epistemology. Suppose you start with a mystical epistemology. You're going to end up with a mystical metaphysics if you're consistent, sooner or later. It's your metaphysics is going to fit your epistemology because your epistemology flowed from your metaphysics.
Now, when he says on this that it is beyond reason, willing, or feeling, that means that we can't know it, God that way. He doesn't mean necessarily that God does not reason, will, or feel.
Just the opposite. It means that God does not reason, feel, or will.
This one, God,
does not have a mind, does not have a will, and does not have any feeling. It's just a metaphysical reality. Without personality.
It's almost like Brahma.
It's exactly like Brahma. That's what it is. This is Hinduism. This is a Western form of Hinduism. It is exactly like the Tao of Taoism, the Brahman of Hinduism. It's exactly like the Holy Other of mysticism, because that's where they got it from. There is, however, another level down. This one flows out, and the next level down is mind. So this non-mind evolves into a mind. And this next level down, which is called emanation, creation ex Deo, out of God. God, this impersonal it, becomes a thinking mind. Now when I say becomes, don't think there was a time when it was not, and then there's a time when it was. This is an eternal process, just like rays rain from an eternal sun. Think of the sun, eternally rain. Or think of center of a circle with eternal radii coming out from it. There never was a time when this all wasn't going on. It's an eternal process. This eternal one is eternally emanating out and becoming mind or nous. Nous emanates eternally from the one. Creation is ex Deo. Three, at this level, self-consciousness is attained by flowing out and looking back. What was unconscious became self-conscious. Out and look back and say, there's me, now I'm conscious of me. Before I flowed out and did that, I wasn't conscious, or to put it another way. Before I made the mirror and looked in it, I couldn't see myself. Once I emanated forth into a mirror and looked in the mirror and saw myself, I became self-conscious. So God literally becomes self-conscious by emanation. The noose is the next level down. And the noose is the source of all emanations below it. All other minds are contained within this mind. All little minds, this is Plato, participate in the big mind. Little M's in the big M. And we are, God is M and we are M and M's. In fact, someone said, you grant Plotinus a noose and he hangs all creation on it. Once you admit there is a noose, then there could be little nieces, or whatever the plural of noose is. World soul is the next level down. You start with the one, you emanate down to the noose, and then you emanate to world soul. When the one reflects inward, it becomes noose. When the noose reflects outward, it produces minds. through soul, it causes other souls, living things. The soul, the outer, is more multiple than mind, the inner. And the heart of Plotinus' system is you move from the simple to the complex, which is really the basis of evolution. Plotinus is the first real Western evolutionist. Moving from the simple to the complex, all that happened to Plotinus is his vertical system from top to bottom was made a horizontal system by Hegel, God unfolding this way. Darwinianism was finding natural selection a method by which you can explain this credibly, quote-unquote, in nature, and you have evolutionism. Spencer got his idea for cosmic evolution by meditating on the waves of a pond. Many of the early evolutionists were pantheists, incidentally, and their influence on Darwin, you can show that Darwin had made up his mind about evolution before he had his, quote, proof from natural selection. Before he ever got on the boat. Read his autobiography. So really, pantheism gives birth to modern evolutionism. With the Christian influence of a horizontal view of, a linear view of history. Then matter, that's on the bottom of the pile. The more you flow out, the more multiple you get. It's kind of like drawing something like this. One can divide into two, but these two can divide into four, and these four can divide into eight. So the farther down you get, the more multiple you get. You start with absolute one, then you go to nous, then you go to world soul, and by the time you get down to matter, down here, well, it really doesn't matter. Because it's so divided, it's so diffuse, it's so multiple, there's just about nothing. You split it one more time, and there'd be nothing. And right down there below matter is absolute nothing. Absolute nothing in his system is evil. Matter is almost, but not quite. Matter is the last remnant of good. That is the last capacity for good with no good in it. Matter is like an empty cup. These almost infinite number of empty cups that have been diffused out there in the overflow from the one, and it doesn't have any good in it. And if you broke it one more time, there wouldn't be any cup there at all. It would be absolutely nothing. So matter is the last remnant of the good as it overflows from top to bottom. So notice several things about his system. Note, there is a descent from unity to multiplicity. There is a hierarchy from the super good to the least good, and from beyond being to the least being. It's a hierarchical system where you start with the most perfect and end up with the least perfect. You start with the most good and end up with the least good. You begin with the most being and end up with the least being, which is just before the brink of oblivion where you have total non-being. Now, in that kind of system, evil, E, is the realm of non-being. Being peters out at matter, the least being. Beyond this, there's total nothingness, evil. Good fades out at matter, the least good. Evil is where there is no being, good, to divide things. Unity is dissipated at matter, the most multiple of all things. And he uses many metaphors to describe this. He says it's kind of like someone leaving the homeland, the fatherland, and drifting away. And he gets so far from the fatherland and the home that he peers over the precipice and the brink of nothingness. He's recoiled that nothingness because he still has a little being, and then the boomerang of being takes him back to the fatherland like a prodigal son. He returns home. So all of nature is a breathing out and a breathing in, just like Brahman. Brahman goes and you exist. Brahman goes, you don't exist. Now it's this level that we want to talk about because that's where man is involved and that's where his epistemology is involved. How do I, down here in the bottom, stuck in the mud, matter, with a mind and a soul, ever get back to my source? The answer is you turn from the external to the internal. You turn from the more multiple to the less multiple. After you turn from the external to the internal, you turn from the internal to the eternal. You go from bodily things, you deny that, asceticism, and you use mysticism. Asceticism from the outside world, mysticism here will help you get back to God. How do you truly know God? You got to turn from matter, turn from body, turn from the physical, meditate, on the spiritual and the unity, meditate on the one until you become one with the one, and then you reach nirvana, the ultimate, whatever you want to call it, beyond being, where you're no longer in a state of thinking, knowing, you're just like the one is, you've gone beyond being, beyond thinking, and you just feel the force flow until you get back to the ultimate source of it.
And it's interact with Aristotle's potentiality, actuality.
No, he did. Plotinus interacted with all of his predecessors. He quotes Aristotle, he quotes Plato, everybody. He knew them very well. That concept works only on the lower levels. Doesn't work on the highest level. The highest level, you go right beyond things that change to the unchanging
the one.
We
can't even say that one has a potential or actual.
The one has no potential or actual.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the word one simply means not many. And that's my next question to you. If he's right, how can we know God? If this metaphysics is right, how do we know God? Can't know him with your mind. Why? Because mind is still one step down. Suppose your mind got the ultimate idea. Suppose you got the perfect idea so that your mind was one with nous. The mind, the logos. What do you got? You're still one step away, one giant step away from the one, because the one doesn't have any mind. The one can't think, and if you're thinking, you still haven't got it. This is exactly Zen Buddhism. This is why they use koans, one hand clapping, you know. Koan is to trick your mind into thinking that your mind shouldn't think. A koan is a way of showing you that as long as you're thinking of true and false, good and evil, you haven't even reached the stage where you're going to possibly understand the Tao. Because when you ask the master, what is the Tao? He says, one hand clapping, and you say, that's absurd. The master says, now you understand. Now you understand. You understand what? You understand that you're still operating down here in the realm of mind or nous, and you're thinking of opposites, and the one goes beyond opposites. There is no good or evil. There is no true or false. True and false, good and evil, are lower level categories of nous and below. And the top level, there is no true or false, good or evil. How do you know that? You can't. You can't know it. You can only experience it. How do you know that you experienced it? That's a good question. We'll answer it better when we go through his epistemology in Roman numeral 3 here, but first, any questions?
Yeah. Can I? If we were to witness, we understand where someone's coming from. Let's say we start to understand the worldview they're operating on. Obviously, dealing with somebody that accepts this, accepts Zen Buddhism, some of these things, using rational evidence for the existence of God, for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, has no bearing on them whatsoever. How do you share?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. Using a rational approach to people who are sympathizing with you, that you're still stuck down on the rational level and you haven't seen the light to get to this higher level, is not going to penetrate very easily, is it? On the other hand, to see the other side of your dilemma, if you say to them, well, I feel Christianity is true, I've intuited Christianity is true, and they say, well, I intuit that Buddhism is true, and the two intuitions come up with mutually exclusive propositions or sets of beliefs, now where are you?
What is truth anyway? We're still low on a lower level when we even talk about truth. Truth is a non-issue.
That's exactly right. For them.
Right.
And yet they write books, give lectures, and try and persuade you of the truth of their view.
So do you try and catch them in that catch-22 there, or do we just wait for their life to collapse when they're looking for some kind of answer to try and meet? There.
I'd say all of the above, but I think we've got to approach them on both levels. I think that there's certain validity to Francis Schaeffer's system of showing where this leads existentially, practically in your life, but I think there's also a philosophical approach that we can show them that there's a catch-22. I mean, you're either claiming your view is true or you're not. If you're not claiming it's true, then it's not in the marketplace of truth. I won't even consider it along with the other options. I'm looking for truth. And if you're not claiming yours is true, then tell me in the introduction and give me and save me a lot of time and money. I won't even buy the book and I won't read it. If, on the other hand, you're claiming or implying your view is true, then you just cut your own throat. Because you're saying true, presumably as opposed to opposite. Surely my view is wrong if I have if I don't accept your view. If your view is true, then mine is false. Then you're actually making a distinction between truth and falsity, which you say can't be made. And I think that's the epistemological level on which they have. Other than that, we've got grunts, groans that we can use. You know, we can each grunt our view. We can each fold our legs and twiddle our thumbs and intuit our view, you know, or maybe we can give a Buddhist smile. We can give a Buddhist smile and we can give a Christian gesture of love. But how are you going to penetrate the cognitive structure? I think you have to do it by showing it's self-defeating.
Have the New Agers resurrected this guy and published his works or anything?
The strange thing about Plotinus is that everybody since Plotinus has resurrected him in one way or another. Augustine, we'll see, Meister Eckhart, the mystics, Hegel, Heidegger, Bultmann, Kierkegaard, and nobody quotes him. Nobody admits where it comes from, and nobody quotes him. I did a whole paper once on a graduate course on Heidegger, Heidegger's main book, Being and Time, in which I showed that his ideas came lock, stock, and barrel out of Plotinus, and never once in any of his writings does he even quote Plotinus.
I would say, be associated with
that. Yeah. Plotinus is one of the most influential and least quoted of all philosophers. American culture you're talking about? We have a mixture of three worldviews. We've got the Judeo-Christian worldview, roughly a third of our country. We have a secular humanistic type view, which is roughly a third, and we have a New Age pantheistic worldview, which is roughly a third. The statistics for the last one would come from Gallup polls, which show one out of every three Americans believes in reincarnation, for example. That two-thirds of Americans read astrology reports and one-half of them believe what they read, that 4 out of 10 Americans have experienced contact with the dead. That would reflect pretty well that third. Then we know the Gallup polls survey show that 1 out of every 3 Americans claims to be a born-again Christian, and the rest are, let's just throw them all in with the secular humanists, they deserve to be together. The rest are in that category. All right, Plotinus' view of faith and knowledge. One, just as all flows from the One, all returns to the One. The One is the source and goal of all things. There's a kind of boomerang of being. As it approaches nothingness, it recoils and returns. As it wanders away from the Father of being, it longs to return home. So you can only go so far. When being peters out and you recoil in the face of non-being, when you peer over the precipice of being into the oblivion of non-being and you feel something in your gut that says turn around and go back, then the whole process turns around and goes back. But unlike the move downward, the move upward is conscious, at least in man. It might not be in an animal or a rock. The way upward is first to turn inward. Is to turn from the outer world, which is asceticism, and to turn to the inner world, which is meditation. Then to return to the absolute unity, which is mysticism. The move is from the external to the internal to the eternal. How mystical union with the One is obtained? Only with great effort. This is not salvation by grace. Only gradually from multiplicity to unity. This is not a LSD experience. Drugs are a shortcut to nirvana, but also have their hang-ups. This is the way to do it, only gradually. Only by a leap of faith. The interesting thing is Plotinus, in my knowledge, is the first one in the history of thought to use this phrase, leap of faith. Comes right out of his Aeneids. Only by a leap of faith. Ultimately, true knowing of God is going to be by faith in Plotinus. Because you can't know him with your mind. You can't see him. You can't sense him with your senses. all you can do is intuit this holy other beyond being totally inconceivable ultimate reality, and that's going to take a fearful leap of faith. You got Kierkegaard right here.
But, you know, I think it's important, like, that Joshua Dell points out that this is not the biblical definition of faith, because the biblical faith is faith based upon something, not just faith based on nothing.
There's a big difference between a leap into the dark and a step into the light. It's a big difference between a leap based on no evidence and a step based on some evidence. And of course, there's a big difference between absolute certainty that is true before you believe it, too.
Because the apostles did not leap. I mean, their faith, the biblical example that we have, they had, you know, like Luke says, many infallible, many, you know, convincing proofs.
Now, on the other hand, as Gordon Clark would point out to you, as I heard him point out in an audience, when somebody presented the whole historical apologetic, and you got your finger in Jesus' hand and your hand in his side, and you got all of this empirical evidence, what did Jesus say to Peter? Flesh and blood hath not revealed this unto thee. On the other hand, you have that mysterious work of the Holy Spirit that generates faith, and you have the other people looking at the same thing and seeing the same thing and not believing. What's the difference? How does faith and reason relate?
I think maybe that's the way that we can witness. You were talking about New Age people. Well, we can witness New Age people. Two is, don't worry about maybe how we're going to convince them when we can't convince them because they aren't looking at it from a rational perspective, but give God's word out and trust that the Holy Spirit will work on their hearts, and they might have problems that he'll use, whatever he'll use. Just
reason only goes so far. Even if we believe that reason is valid and that reason does provide evidence, you can lead the horse to the water with reason, but you can't make him drink. No one's been ever argued into the kingdom. You don't find God at the end of a syllogism. The real God is a God that ultimately you're going to have to experience and know by faith. That's the other side of the story. And herein is the struggle all the way through, faith and reason. How far? How do they relate? All right, the next point, three. I guess we're on 2C. When you make this leap of faith to the One, says Plotinus, there is no positive knowledge of the One. And there is no reason to leap to the One. It's not that, hey, you came to the point you think it's very reasonable to make this leap, because you can't go any farther by reason, and reason tells you that you can't go any farther by reason, so it's reasonable to leap. Not that at all. That would be a Christian idea of the relation of faith and reason. We'll see that later in Augustine Aquinas. This is reason is of no use to you at all. You may as well scrap it. It got you here. This is like Wittgenstein saying in the of his Tractatus, I got you to the top of the roof this way, but that was just a ladder, and you got to kick the ladder away. And the only way you're going to get on is by faith and the mystical. You got into it because the linguistic can tell you about the world, but God is beyond the world. He's mystical, and that can't tell you anything at all about it. So there's no reason to leap. There's no knowledge of the One to which you're leaping. It is literally a leap before you look, or a leap because you cannot look.